All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to season 2, episode 3 of Los Políticos. Bienvenidos. It is October 25th, 2021, and we're on the other side of Hispanic Heritage Month and quickly moving into Hispanic holiday party season. So let me do our quick introduction to remind everybody who you're listening to. We, of course, have Joel Alvarado, New Yorican progressive Afro-Latino government affairs consultant who once called Brooklyn home, but is now a proud Southerner. We have Jason Anavitarte, another Puerto Ricano senator from District 31 in Paulding County, an all-star Republican, and myself, Chris Perlera, Salvadoran, Guanaco, if you will, transplant by way of Massachusetts, and then Athens, Georgia, UGA grad and strategic partnerships and messaging consultant. So, Joel, will you take us away and introduce our very special guest?
I will, but I got to figure out how to become an all-star Democrat. I mean, if
we wrote our own bios, so that Jason said, I'm an all-star.
We need about 3 episodes to figure that out for you, Joel, sir.
Okay, well, I think we got time. I'll work on it. I'm going to get to all-star status. Anyway, I'm just really glad and honored to be able to introduce Mark Hugo Lopez, who's Director of Race and Ethnicity Research at the Pew Research Center. And let me just say, if you're not getting your research from the Pew Research Center, you're doing it wrong. I mean, it is a phenomenal a repository of just drilling down data for those of us who, I think one of my colleagues said, nerds out on this type of work. It's a great place to really understand what's happening in the moment and what could be happening in the future. So anyway, before I get into this this lengthy bio, because this man has done so much, and he's a credit to the work he's doing. I just want to talk real quick about how we met. I think we were on a panel last year during the heart of COVID for AARP, right?
Yes, I think that's right. Yeah.
I didn't realize you guys look so good for your age.
Well, I'm a proud member of AARP. I have no problem with that. And I still look 35, so it's all good. But we met, we talked, and I was excited to because I've read your work for a while, because you have been with Pew for a minute, and so especially the work you were doing, especially within the Latino community. And so I reached out to you, we had a meeting, we talked, it was really, really a warm conversation just about sort of my thoughts about what's happening in the South and what you're seeing regarding the data, what the data is telling you, how excited you were about the upcoming census and what it would tell us. And then also, you know, we talked about my passion about Afro-Latinidad, you know, just having representation. And like one of the things that I tell people all the time when I do my talks that I got from Q, that in 10 years ago, about 1 million people self-identified as Latino and Black. Now it's 2.4 million. And you're the mathematician, I'm not, but I know that's a huge percentage of a jump. And just, it's data like that that's important for us to have. So anyway, not being said about that, I'm just glad that we met. And I'm glad that you're doing the work you're doing. So again, Mark Hugo Lopez, Director of Race and Ethnicity Research at Pew Research Center, where he leads planning of the center's research agenda focused on chronicling the diverse, ever-changing racial and ethnic landscape of the United States. He is an expert on issues of racial and ethnic identity, Latino politics and culture, the U.S. Hispanic and Asian American populations, global and domestic immigration, and the U.S. demographic landscape. Lopez was previously the Center's Director of Global Migration and Demography and of Hispanic Research. Lopez is the co-editor of Adjusting to a World in Motion, Trends in Global Migration and Migration Policy. He is a co-author of The Future of the First Amendment and has contributed chapters to several books about voting and young Latinos. Prior to joining Pew Research Center, Lopez served as a research assistant professor at the University of Maryland School of Public Policy and as a research director, the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement, commonly known as CIRCLE. Lopez received his doctorate in economics from Princeton University. He is the author of reports about Hispanic electorate, Hispanic identity, and immigration. Lopez frequently appears on national and international media in both Spanish and English. Los Políticos family, welcome Mark Hugo Lopez to the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Before we delve into these questions, Mark, there's a couple of things we just want, a couple of housekeeping items we got to take care of. Jason next week is going to have a busy 2 weeks on his hands. Something that is related to the work you do. Next week, the Georgia General Assembly will be convening in order to redraw their maps. It's reapportionment and redistricting. So just give us a little snapshot, if you will, Jason, about what we should be expecting next week. And then from there, we'll let Mark say a couple of words, and then we'll jump into these questions.
Yeah, I mean, I can't really say much, but just redistricting is going to happen next couple weeks. I'm sure it's going to be a very fun and very arduous time on everybody. But real quick, Joel, I also want to jump in and just talk about the next 2 weeks. We'll be watching the Los Bravos hopefully bring home the World Series. And, you know, it's a great thing to see the World Series in Atlanta, unlike the All-Star game. So just want to kind of put that there.
I don't know if our guest knows keeps up with the petty partisan rivalry over here.
Can't help it. But I think for all of us, you know, we're cheering on the Braves, and hopefully they're going to bring home a World Series over the next 2 weeks. So.
That's true. We all want that.
Yeah, especially since the Yankees are not playing, it's a really good chance they should get it. So I'm feeling good about it. Definitely. I'll definitely have my Braves hat on. So, Mark, welcome, man. Just a couple of words you want to offer before we jump into it?
Yes, I'm a Dodgers fan. So just saying. But let's talk a little bit about what this last census has brought, because I think the last census revealed a number of things nationally and also for the South, but particularly for Georgia, about the nation's Hispanic population and how important it has been for the nation's population growth overall. So first, some numbers.
Perfect.
How many Latinos were counted in the 2020 census? 62.1 million. That's up from about 50.5 million in 2010. So the Hispanic population grew by over 11 million people. What's interesting about that growth, though, is that about 5.5 million of that growth, so nearly half, happened in the South. Now, the South is a pretty big region. That covers Texas to Florida to Tennessee to, it's a pretty wide region. And Georgia, of course, is a key and important part of that story. But the South has had the fastest growing Hispanic population for a number of decades now. Looking all the way back to the 90s, the fastest growing Hispanic population has always been in the South, and South population growth of Hispanics has accounted for almost half of the national Hispanic population growth. Texas and Florida are a big part of that story. I want to stress that that's where a lot of this growth is coming from. But what else did we learn from the 2020 census, particularly to the South, and particularly to Georgia? So in Georgia, the census counted 1.1, almost 1.2 million Hispanics living in the state of Georgia, making up about 11% of the state's population. What's so striking about Georgia, though, is that Georgia had been number 10 on the list of states by Hispanic population back in 2010, and had emerged as the one southern state really in that list. Now among the top 10, first off, Georgia knocked New Mexico out of the top 10, so New Mexico is no longer in the top 10, which is one of the traditional longstanding Hispanic states. And then the second part of this is that North Carolina, together with Georgia, are now in the top 10 of states by Hispanic population, number 9 and number 10, Georgia 9, North Carolina 10. Which really is, again, a striking shift from where the nation was 40 or 50 years ago when we were talking about Hispanic population. So those are just, I think, some important key facts to keep in mind. One other thing about the South, though, where has the fastest growth in percentage terms been happening? Yes, Texas and Florida accounted for the most in terms of the biggest number of increases in people in terms of population numbers. However, the fastest growing have been in the what I would call the non-traditional states. The states like Alabama, like Tennessee, mm-hmm. like Kentucky, places that have not traditionally in the past had large Hispanic populations, but do now. And that really is the big story, I think, for the South, which is that non-traditional states grew faster. And also there's been a dispersion of the Hispanic population within the South across places, rural places particularly, that 20, 30 years ago had very few Latinos to begin with. So again, those are just some basic facts. As you know, I could go on this, but I just sort of, I think, sets the stage for our conversation.
Yeah, no, those are great stats. I think right now, obviously these live perpetually in your mind as ever updating figures and intuition in terms of what you want to see next time. We process, but not everybody has the privilege and the pleasure of making this their career. So we appreciate it.
Thank you. I was going to say one other thing that I would add about the national story of the Hispanic population was the count revealed. The profile of Hispanics by race that was different than what we had seen in 2010. And notice that I say different. Mm-hmm. I say different because it's a little bit about the way the data was collected. a different question about racial identity and the state of the nation today about awareness of ancestry, but particularly around racial identity. So this year, one of the things that was so different about this year's, 2020's data collection from the census was that 20% of Latinos said that they were white and only white. But that was down from 53% in 2010 who said they were white or only white.
Thank goodness.
What really increased was the share that said that they're mixed race. People who say that they're white and something else and so forth. And the biggest combination of people is white and something else. So many Latinos are telling us they're two or more races, a much different share than back in 2010 when only 6% said that. But in 2020, 33% or a third of Latinos tell us that they are of two or more races. The share who said there's some other race, which is another very important measure, and usually people will say they're Hispanic is their race in the some other race category, that was the single largest group at 42%. So 42% of Latinos say there's some other race, 33% say they're two or more, and 20% say they're white alone, and then about 2% say they're Black, about 1% say they're Asian or American Indian. But as you can see, this is a very different distribution than what we got in 2010. Lots of reasons for that. I think some technical ones play an important role here, but it's interesting to see what people reported.
Yeah, well, you can go into that.
Yeah, you know, man, you really, Mark, you just like filling my head with just
this is the
questions.
Look Joel gets on his face when he's about to talk for 20 minutes.
Yeah. I'm trying not to get on the soapbox, but it just, I feel like you need to be like a two-part series because it's just, you're just a wealth of knowledge. But, you know, part of it, I was curious, the data that you were talking about self-identity, was that disaggregated by age? Because I'm curious of whether the thrust of that is because of younger people sort of really leaning into intersectionality and leaning into identity, or, you know, did you see any growth in, let's say, older Latinos who maybe are more traditional in how they identify themselves?
It's a great question, and there is a pattern by age. So again, this is data that comes straight from the decennial census itself. So it comes from what the Census Bureau has shared and published. So there's two reasons why younger Latinos, whether under 18 or people who might be, say, 18 to 35, might be more likely to say they're more two or more races. Part of that is that in the case of the children, those under 18, their parents may be of two different groups. So their parents may be an intermarried couple, meaning a Hispanic with a non-Hispanic person. And that may be why you're seeing so many under 18 as being two or more races. But the 18 to 34 grouping is yet another group that may be the children of an intermarried couple, but also could be people claiming their identity, becoming aware of their identity in a way and claiming that in a different way. Now, it could also just be that the Census Bureau captured data better. So it could be that there hasn't been a change, it's just that we're actually getting a better read now of the ways in which people see their identity. So there's a lot here to explain and to think about, but no matter what, the way we've captured this in the census for 2020 suggests that there is a real sense of identity that extends across multiple racial backgrounds, multiple views. Latinos are not a monolith, that they are a very diverse group, and that diversity includes a lot of interracial and inter-ethnic backgrounds.
And I want to point out a funny anecdote that I have no idea where I read this, but I, you know, as we acquire and digest so much in listicles and short articles, I vaguely remember it, but I always remember that it said Latino men are disproportionately likely to have relationships as a friendship and also as partners outside of their race, which is funny now, you know, as we're making conjecture about what's going on, that under 18 is the biggest populace of mixed race. Because we're out there mixing it up.
So, you know, actually, to give you another stat, and sorry to throw so many numbers, stop me if I'm doing.
We love stats. We love stats.
If you look at Hispanic newlyweds, you'll find that in 2019, so before the pandemic, among newlyweds, 30% of Hispanic newlyweds married somebody who was not Hispanic. More often than not, the person they married was a white non-Hispanic person. That's the single most common intermarriage pairing that you'll see. When you take a look at it among U.S.-born Latinos, The intermarriage rate among newlywed U.S.-born Latinos was 39%. So how does that compare to other groups? Well, it's higher than it is for Asians, which is at about 28%. And it's much higher than it is for Blacks or for whites, which are more around 20% each. So when you're looking at intermarriage rates, Latinos are more likely to be intermarried than any other group. And of all intermarried couples in the United States, 42% are white, non-Hispanic, married to a Hispanic spouse, meaning that Hispanics are among the group that's most likely to be intermarried.
Wow.
So some very, very interesting numbers of patterns that we've been seeing.
We can go deep into the rabbit hole with this one, man. We gotta make sure we go for air. So let's go ahead and jump into our questions. I'll start it off. But usually our listeners know that we start off with something called what's on our political mind. But we wanted to skip that part because we wanted to really speak to you, Mark, more. I mean, we cared more about what you were going to offer us as opposed to dealing with that segment. So we just kind of scrapped it and said, look, let's just jump in both feet into the water and see what happens. So for me, again, like I said before, I like a million questions I want to ask you, and I have like a minute to do so. So I can't really get into it, but I think we should definitely frame the conversation. But we did jump in pretty quickly. Into the deep end. I think let's go ahead and go back into the shallow waters, if I may. Let's just some basic questions. Like, you know, why should Latinos care about the census first? And what does the latest census reveal about Latinos in the Southeast? You alluded to a little earlier. And just kind of identify something that really stood out for you, like something that you're like, wow, I did not see that coming.
So great question. So first, why should Latinos and frankly, the general US public care about the census? Well, the census is important for a number of reasons, but most, perhaps among its two most important functions are to one, engage in redistricting at the state level, because every 10 years, the nation redraws its congressional districts and many other political entities as well, like state districts and so forth for a state house. So the census is the basis for that redrawing. It's something that's required by the Constitution, and that's what is done as its primary objective. And then the second, I think, very important thing to keep in mind is that the census count, and that count particularly at the local level, plays an important role in shaping how much money goes to those locations in terms mm-hmm. of educational money, in terms of infrastructure, in terms of planning for fire departments and police departments. All of these things, of course, have an impact on Latinos and non-Latinos alike in those locations. So, but why the special interest from Latinos, perhaps? Well, partly because Latinos are such an important part of the nation's demographic story today. Half of the nation's population growth came from Latinos over the last decade. And that's important, I think, to keep in mind, because that's a story that's happening across the country. It's not just in California and Texas. In fact, those places have many Latinos and they're important for growth there, but also Latinos are shaping population growth in other places like North Dakota and South Dakota. And in the cases of states like, say, Texas, are helping to drive a growth in the number of congressional seats that a place like Texas is receiving or a place like New Jersey may not be losing. So the Latino population story is one that's driving potentially some and shaping potentially politics in the next decade because of the way in which that's impacted reapportionment of congressional seats and also the way that it could potentially impact redrawing within states of congressional districts and state assembly districts as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, preaching to the choir. Money and influence.
I think also, though, it's an interesting story to tell just on identity purposes alone. Who identifies as Latino? So what do we know about that population? And so the census in that respect alone feeds into an ongoing trend nationally among Latinos and non-Latinos alike to know more about their backgrounds and where they're coming from. And so somebody in the future is probably going to look back at the 2020 census to find their grandparents, and they're going to find that information about what people shared 70 plus years from now.
Thank you. Jason, what you got?
So, Mark, one of my thoughts or I guess questions, really just someone who's really interested in education, served on the school board, uh-huh. My wife's a teacher, just really around just what we've seen with the pandemic around, you know, academic progress of children across the country with Latino and Latino families. Mm-hmm. What are some of the trends and challenges maybe you've seen over the last mm-hmm. year and a half that we should be mindful of, or maybe we should be, as policymakers, be thinking about? Because one of my concerns, especially for Latino families who are living in poverty, you know, how do we overcome a lot of these barriers to ensure that, you know, there's kind of the quote unquote, you know, catching up to, you know, where academically kids should be, but also too, I think under the economic challenges we see as budget makers, policymakers, because of inflation or other factors, you know, we have these new barriers that are popping up. So how do we really kind of advance kids and families to where maybe they need to be? But what's some data points maybe you've seen around that?
We did a survey of Hispanic adults earlier this year that asked about the impact of COVID on their lives. And we asked particularly around how it impacted families, people who have children. And we found that, for example, childcare has been an issue, not just for Latinos, but for many people who have children. But for Latinos, we found that 30% of Hispanic mothers said that it had been very difficult to make childcare arrangements during the COVID-19 outbreak. Among Hispanic fathers, that number was maybe about 20%. So this the challenges of securing childcare have been particularly impactful, have had a particular impact on Hispanic mothers. And I think that's important to keep in mind because many of them are unable to work from home. Many of them just had no choice but had to go to work and sometimes work in places or in jobs that are very public facing. It's not true of everybody, but it's perhaps more so true for Latinos than it is for other groups of Americans. Though again, not entirely so. It depends on the place and depends on many other things. The second thing that I think is an important impact of COVID-19 and some of the policies that were immediately implemented and had an impact on families is education by Zoom. In other words, doing education or classroom learning online. And Latinos appear to be more likely to have had that than other groups of Americans, according to some of our surveys, which is very interesting. So many Latinos had their children working from home. But we also found that many Latino parents are concerned that their kids have fallen behind, particularly those whose children have had no choice but to do their instruction online. And that again is something that comes from our recent survey about this. And so I'd say that when we talk about Hispanic parents and Hispanic youth, COVID-19 had an impact on childcare arrangements, and it had an impact on parents being concerned about their children falling behind. But I want to contrast that though with some other important data points. And that's important to note that longstanding trends are continuing. So for example, the high school dropout rate for Hispanics has been declining, and it continues to decline nationally. It's down sharply in the last 20 years. Today, maybe about 8% of Hispanic young people may not finish high school, but it used to be about 30%+ back in the 1990s. So we've seen a huge decline in that, and that's happening across the country. Second part is with that decline in high school dropout rates, that means more Latinos are ready to go to college, and we're seeing record numbers attend college now. Now, many maybe may get distracted and don't finish, but we have over 3.5 million Latinos now enrolled in colleges and universities, 2-year and 4-year, and that is a record number. They make up almost 20% of college-going students today. That is also about where you would expect it, given their population share among young people. And so we're seeing some real progress, at least in going. But many young Latinos over the years have told us at Pew Research that the cost of a college education is a challenge. Some have to get work in order to be able to make ends meet. This seems to be impacting perhaps men more than women. So Hispanic women are finishing college, getting a 4-year degree at a rate that's higher than their Hispanic male counterparts. And to give you two numbers, 25% of young Hispanic women ages 25 to 29 have finished college and have a college degree. So 25%. For men, it's only about 15% of the same age group. Both of those numbers are up from 10 years ago, but Hispanic women are really taking off in terms of closing the gap. That's
much better.
Yeah, much better. So when you take a look at it, you'll see that there's a lot of optimism, but COVID-19 has really thrown a few speed bumps in the way and has made it hard for some folks to be able to make ends meet because of childcare challenges and the type of instruction that the Hispanic parents are seeing their kids receive.
And I have Jason, let me butt in here super fast in regards to the specific information of parents fearing that online learning created a larger gap for our children than for everybody else. You know, I'm working on a project with Gigi Pedraza, the Latino Community Fund. Shout out Gigi, one of our close friends and listeners. about the impact on English learners, or traditionally known as ESOL students. Is in any of your data or any of the research collection methodologies, is that addressed, like the difference between those that are also learning English in addition to general academic?
We do see that it's more of a concern for immigrant parents than it is for U.S.-born parents around childcare, particularly kids falling behind, their children falling behind. So it's not directly a link because we didn't quite get it the way you just described it. We don't know if their children are ESOL or not, or English as a second language students or not. But it does seem that there are some patterns here that match the story that you just told.
Okay. Correlatorily likelihood.
Correlatorily likely. Yes, I like that phrase. Thank you.
Thank you. Jason, back to you.
Jason, can I jump in for one real quick, Jason? Since you're giving out free passes, let me get a free pass too. Mark, I'm curious because Jason said something that, and I don't know if you have this data in front of you or if Pew collected it, but I'm really curious about Latinos and access to broadband. In Georgia, we're having a really big conversation about broadband inequity, right? And where it's not just rural, but or even urban parts of the state. There are people who just don't have the infrastructure to be able to access like others. And I know that, Jason, he's vice chair of the Senate Education Committee, Education and Youth Committee at the Senate. So I know that, trying to ensure that the students have access to all these tools is a big thing too. It's not just the hardware like a computer, but just to be able to the basic broadband. So I'm just curious if that's something that Pew has collected or any data has come to you about that, or is it something you have readily available that you can share with our listeners?
We do have something readily available. If listeners are interested, they can look for our Pew Research Center Internet and Broadband Fact Sheet, which has a lot of really great information about who uses the internet. And it's something we've been tracking for many years. To give you some sense of this, a lot of the gaps have closed. So when we talk about, for example, Hispanics overall, you'll find that about 95% of Hispanics tell us that they have access to the internet, which is about on par with other groups of Americans. But when it comes to home broadband use, this is where you start to see some differences. So for example, 65% of Hispanics, according to a February 2021 survey from us, said that they had access to broadband connection at home. By comparison, among whites, 80% do. So there does remain a gap, even though that gap has closed and Latinos have made progress over the decades in closing the broadband gap, they still lag. I would say though that one thing that our data does not get at, but we used to look at this and I'm sure that it's still there, is that most of the gap between Latinos and non-Latinos is oftentimes coming from the gap within the Latino population that exists between US-born English speakers and foreign-born Spanish speakers. Spanish-speaking Latinos, particularly immigrant Latinos, have been among the least likely to have a broadband connection, and many of them are in rural areas in the South, for example. And this is a group that oftentimes also does, when it comes to, I think, a very interesting policy lever, also relies on libraries, public libraries, to access the internet as a place to go and to, say, do a job application or do some sort of web search, even though they may not have, even on their phone, a data plan that allows them to connect to the internet. Now, these gaps have all closed over the years, so the gaps are getting smaller, but it is a persistent gap. It's something that we see in a lot of the data we've collected over the years, that is that Spanish speakers and those who were born in another country are among the least likely among Latinos to have access to the internet or to a broadband connection and rely on public services like libraries in order to gain that access.
I'm not going to say anything else because I know Jason wants to talk and I'm going to wait for my portion.
I just have one question, Mark, just kind of follow up. You touch on about, what we're seeing in terms of single income families or, the trend of disruption of income into families. Do you think it's a short term or long term trend, or is it too early to tell that we're in a paradigm shift potentially of seeing an exponential increase of single income families in the Latino community, over the long term because of the economic and socioeconomic dynamics we're seeing, whether it's related to COVID or other economic factors?
It's a really good question. So certainly we've seen that about half of Latino households say that somebody in their household lost a job or or took a pay cut because of COVID, which is among the highest shares. In fact, I'm sorry, it's the highest share among all the different racial and ethnic groups in the country. So COVID has had a big impact. But Latinos have also rebounded more quickly than other groups. And so the unemployment rate for Latinos shot up to over 18% in April of 2020, we're at the peak of the close, shutdown and everything. And it took some time for that to come back down. But Latinos are now at about an unemployment rate of about 8% or so, not at the low they were at before COVID hit. Been back in late 2019, we were at a historic low for unemployment rates for Latinos. So Latinos have recovered and we've seen some good progress there. But there's some bigger trends happening as well. So you highlighted maybe COVID has had some impact on creating single households with only a single income, which may have been a double income household before, but somebody lost a job and hasn't recovered yet. That is happening. But the second part of this is that Latinos are also seeing slower population growth rate, which means smaller families, which means that Latinos are looking more like other Americans now as it becomes a more settled U.S.-born population. And so the patterns of single-income households may be something we see more of among Latinos, but I think it remains to be seen. One last point, though. It took Latinos about 10 years to recover from the Great Recession. So the Great Recession had an impact on Hispanic incomes. And Hispanic incomes didn't come back to where they had been until maybe about 2017, 2018. And so we only had a few years of Latinos actually seeing growth and coming out of that hole after the Great Recession, and then COVID hits and they get hit again very hard. Despite all of that, though, our surveys continue to show that about half of Hispanic adults say that they expect a brighter financial future for their children than they themselves have had. That is more optimistic about the future than you see for the general U.S. public. So there's a mix of story here, but I think it only goes to show you that there's a lot of nuance in this story for Latinos. And those who are college educated and were able to work from home, they didn't have as much of a hit as those who couldn't work from home during this COVID recession. So Latinos too have a story of people who have not been as impacted and have been able to buy homes and save despite the impact of the COVID-19 recession.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating. And because Mark, I feel like for our community, and this is, you know, this is a cultural comment, maybe a generational comment, but you know, whether you're my grandparents, you know, and then my parents living with their parents and then the grandkids, like, you know, everybody working together to kind of build those family incomes together, whether it's through business or you name it. I feel like, you know, those historical trends we've seen for the last 50 years in our community, I think kind of when economic crisis or crisis happens in America, I kind of feel like those kind of, we'll call them cultural trends or things that are known to our families, maybe more so than other, you know, groups, however you want to call it, I think, you know, kind of stands out. I think kind of, you know, where we're at today, embedded in some of that data. So that's pretty fascinating stuff.
Thank you for saying that, because I think that that's an important part of the story that we should emphasize, which is that in some ways, despite these trends of living in the U.S. impacting Hispanic households, making them smaller, et cetera, Latinos do tend to live in multi-generational households more so than other Americans. Although nationally, there is a movement back towards multi-generational households among all Americans, not just a Latino story. But also that when you take a look at the within Latino story, small business creation has been an important part of the economic story for Latinos in the last 10 years and for the nation as a whole, frankly. But again, many Latino businesses that are started tend to be single proprietor. So they usually don't have employees or smaller and so forth. So there's a mixed story here too, but it is very interesting to see some of these traditions that people bring with them from their home countries and or that people trace to their ancestors who come from another country, that is still part of the Hispanic story in a number of ways.
Yeah, maybe on a future show, we can unpack that some, because I think it's a pretty fascinating discussion we could have around that.
I'll go ahead and jump in. We were thinking, as we, you know, think of outlandish and cool ideas to do, you know, in the future, maybe have you as like a virtual guest, and we have our folks in the room and have some pre-chosen and then some questions at large, just to be able to talk about this, especially, you know, as we talk how Southern Hispanic communities are very different from your New Yorks, your Chicago's, your LA's, and just add a little context that an anecdote doesn't tell everything, but when you have data for everything, it really paints a story and a clearer picture with the anecdote. So thank you. Yeah. I want to piggyback off of the broadband question, because I know that in some of the methodologies I've seen that a lot of that broadband and internet accessibility comes in the form of phones. Yeah, you're pointing at me. The audience is not going to see that, but he's pointing at me. And so I'm a big, I grew up with a computer in my hand. My parents put a Packard Bell, like huge desktop setup on layaway when I was in elementary school. They had no idea why, but for some reason they were like, my child needs a computer. We just feel like this is going to make him successful. And it was true. Like, I've been building my own computer since I was 14. And so I'm always very cognizant of this. And one of the stories that I've gotten amidst my community work and projects is that there is a there's an overarching fear in especially immigrant Latino households that they don't want to take their technology home. Like, they're afraid they're going to break the Chromebook, and then they're going to, obviously we know that a Chromebook can be as cheap as like $100, maybe less. But there's like there are rumors that are perpetuated between the Spanish speaking Hispanic community versus the native born that is a little, they're like, oh no, there's an insurance plan. We read the document and they made sure to tell us. I was like, oh, well, they only told you in English. So all the Spanish speakers think that if you break it, you bought it. Did you have any information in terms of data being, or internet being accessed by type of device?
Yes, we do. And it's actually, I think, an important part of the story. So first off, we haven't quite explored the data to provide data for the story that you just told, which I think is a very interesting story, but it echoes many other things where there is a difference in understanding and a difference in experience for Spanish speakers versus those who are US born and or English speakers, who generally are more in the know because they've grown up here in the States. They speak with other folks and who are also US born. And so there's a certain understanding that develops. But you asked an important question. What about the devices that people use? Well, first off, Latinos are less likely to have a desktop at home or a laptop at home than other groups of Americans. And we've developed this measure at the Pew Research Center about a group of Americans who are called smartphone dependent. In other words, they don't have a computer at home, but they access the internet through a smartphone. Now, you talk to marketers, some marketers will characterize this Latino story as one of Latinos have leapfrogged other Americans to become mobile and compared to others. And there's some truth to that. There's certainly the indication that maybe Latinos are adopting mobile technology more so, maybe because of costs, maybe because of other things, maybe because they're forward-looking and they're leaving the past behind. But here's what we found. So what share of Latino adults are smartphone dependent? That is, they have a smartphone, but they don't have a desktop at home. 1/4. So 1/4 of Latino adults are what we would call smartphone dependent. What is it for white Americans? Only 12%. What about for black Americans? 17%. So Latinos have long been the most smartphone dependent group of Americans in our data over the years. Now, they're less so than they were, say, back in 2018. Back then, we measured that number at about 35% for Hispanics. Today, again, the number is 25%. So there's been a decline as Latinos have, perhaps because of school programs, been able to have a laptop at home. But I don't want to underemphasize the importance of public institutions like libraries in providing a place where people can access the internet with the computer. And again, for the very group that is least likely to have a computer at home, the foreign-born Spanish speaker segment of the Hispanic population, libraries and some of our surveys we've found have been a very important resource and a way to gain access to information that is sometimes only online, and also to get help, by the way, to fill out your tax form or to fill out a job application.
That's fantastic. And I have a couple sample questions here that I've been writing, but we were talking about while we were figuring out our Zoom call information, just about the oddity that we represent in a country that we're still, you know, developing, and really just, you know, the type of work you do is not statistically common in any population. And it's also true for us here in the South, working in government, politics, community as professionals, not just volunteers. I want to know your story a little bit more about how, you know, did you ever think that you were going to be in this? I don't know how many generations removed your parents are in this country. Do they have any concept of what you do? Because I joke about that all the time.
It's a great question. I don't even know where to start. So let me start with a little bit of the Lopez story, because I think it's important to know what generation I am. So I am third generation U.S. born. So I was born in the U.S. My parents were also born in the U.S. It was my grandparents who came to the U.S. Frankly, as children. They entered the U.S. Through, and my dad's side, through El Paso, which we have information about during the Mexican Revolution. So my family has been in the U.S. over a century now. They settled in Southern California on my dad's side and my mom's side after some time in Arizona, and worked as farm workers, as meat packers in Southern California. When I was born, I'm the last of four, so I'm U.S. born. I remember my dad being very involved in the Chicano movement in Southern California, locally. He ran for school board. He was doing things like having dual bilingual education programs for both the Spanish speakers and the English speakers, which didn't go over well with some people. Also, he had a reversed busing program that had many Latino students, Mexican-American students, being bused from the Mexican-American community to a largely white community to keep the white school open because there weren't enough students to support it otherwise. And he wanted to close down that school, so he got recalled. So the reason why I'm telling you all of this is that, you know, that recall election and the loss that he had as a result of that shaped a lot of the conversations I had with my father at the time and as I went into school. So I always have been interested in data, particularly about Latinos and Mexican Americans in the United States. And so my undergraduate degree was in economics. My doctoral degree is in economics as well, but always with a focus on data and understanding the U.S. Latino population. I never thought I would be at a place like Pew Research, and I thought I was going to be a professor. I was a professor for many years, for 13 years at the University of Maryland. Loved it, loved working with students. But it wasn't until I came to Pew Research that I really started focusing on Latinos in a way that I never had before. Now, as I said to you, I'm an economist. Many people think I'm a demographer because I talk about demography so much. Some sociologists, when they find out I'm an economist, will say, "You're the nicest economist I know."
You have a lot of social skills for an economist.
For an economist, yeah, exactly. But that's how I got to where I am. Now, my parents were always there and supportive from the very beginning. They would come. I used to be in the marching band in Berkeley when I was in college. And they would be at every football game. Sometimes even, I don't know if any of you do this to your children, but they wouldn't tell me they were coming to Berkeley. They would just show up and I'd see our car drive by and I'm like, "Is that my dad? And he's taking pictures of me?" And, you know, sort of stalking me without really telling me about it. But it just shows you how much they were supportive of me all the way through.
Great parents. So,
fortunately, my dad passed away before I finished my PhD, so he never got to see all of this. But my mom was very, very proud of it. But I will say, the family doesn't understand exactly what I do, even to this day. What people understand is they'll say something to me like, "What was it like to be at the studio at CNN? Did they put makeup on you?"
That's exactly the same story I get.
Yeah, and you know, it's way people can identify with it. It's something that they can physically, you know, put their minds around and, or grasp onto. And when I explain what it is that I do, they find it interesting. They love to watch my interview. I might get some questions, but I know that for my family, this isn't something that, you know, was part of growing up or who we were. I'm the first one to go and get a PhD in something like economics. And so, and I still to this day remain the one who's gone the farthest in the family in this respect.
Very cool story. And even that is literally the joke I tell. I was like, my parents don't know what I do, but they do remember that I'm on TV sporadically. And then they ask me how much they pay me, and I say $0 for the TV stuff. And they're like,
"Well, you know, Mark, try explaining to your family that you're a lobbyist. I don't even know where to begin with that. I just tell people I work in government. I work, you know, I help people interface with government. I try to find a way to. But you know what? But that's an important conversation that we need to open up, sort of the possibility of us, right? Where we are, where people need to see us in these different spaces and knowing that, I mean, why can't we as Latinos, you know, be a state senator, be an economist, you know, be work government relations and external affairs and have these types of questions. I mean, that's what this is about, right? It's about letting people know the possibility of what Latinos could do and are doing, and we need more of. So, you know, I do appreciate the story because I think your story is an intrinsically American story, right? Yes. And people need to, we need to own that. We need to own our stories as well and let people know that, you know, we're not other. We are, as American, as anybody else. And that's why we do Los Pols too, because we want people, let people know that we're Latinos and proud of it. We're also proud Southerners. And, you know, this is our home, and we're not going anywhere anytime soon. And we want to contribute to the greatness that the South is. So we want to let people know that we can be both Latino and Southern and be proud of both.
That's right. You hit on a lot of things I think that are important to keep in mind. I just wanted to add one other thing about my own story, which is that I've always found that one of the most important things I can do is to be a resource to other Latinos, particularly students and younger Latinos, and be a mentor if I can. Partly because I think that oftentimes just having somebody who you can ask questions of without feeling nervous about it is important. And also it's one of the ways that I feel that I can connect with folks the way that my father connected with me. So it's a way for me to be able to connect with many young people. And if I can help, I would love to be able to help. I will say, though, that sometimes my nieces and nephews will say to me that they're scared of talking to me because of how much I've been able to do. And they don't want to talk about their grades or college. And so we never talk about it. I didn't realize I was stressing them out, but I can see that sometimes that happens. But you're so right that this is the American story in many ways. And there's no one single story that it describes or makes this nation what it is. But I will say that I feel a tremendous pride in being from this country, despite all the challenges that the country faces, because my story is one of an American, it is a very American, a very U.S. story. That's something that I think is both exciting to study, which is what we do at Pew Research, but it's also exciting to be a part of it.
Yeah, great. Well, I'm going to close this out. I mean, you've been a fantastic guest. I think you've given us just all the information that we casually were like, oh, we should look that up. It's like, I can't find it. It's not in the right format that I want. But you're just like, it's in here. It's in my brain. So, so thank you. I'm going to close us out. So we wanted to make a quick reminder to everybody that, you know, a lot of times people see us at parties, and I was making the joke about it's the, you know, Hispanic Heritage Month may be over, but it's Hispanic holiday season. And most of our parties are still on. So you'll find us at, like, you know, the Georgia Hispanic Chamber of Commerce galas, probably the Latin American Chambers, the Hispanic Construction Association, which they have their own kind of like data collection thing with Emory right now, because you probably know it's hard to collect when people don't want to talk to the government. The Latinx Forum with Ser Familia and LCF. So you'll see us around. Please check out their respective websites if you want to, you know, get tickets or support virtually. Of course, if you want to check out some of the work of our guest, Mark Hugo Lopez, you know, head over to Pew Research and look at their topics on race and ethnicity. But that's a wrap. So gracias por su atención. Thank you for listening. To learn more about us, go to lospoliticos.net. Follow us wherever you can find your favorite podcasts, Spotify, Google, Apple Podcasts, wherever they are. Until next time, hasta la próxima. Muchas gracias y hasta luego.